Carrboro.
This is WCOMLP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. This is the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom Wednesday afternoon show. I'm going to start you out with a little music just to remind you.
Got it.
This is the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom show, the Wake Up Call. We just introduced our show with some music by Fred Ho, a strong revolutionary who passed away recently and whose memorial service was held in New York City this past Saturday. So I thought we'd put a little bit of his jazz on the air. I'm Dick Paddock, co-host of the show and button pusher, and across from me is Lorraine Hoyt, our other co-host. Let you go ahead with the show.
Okay, well, the show is the WILF wake-up call, WILF being the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. It's kind of a lengthy title, but WILF has been a lengthy organization. It's one of the oldest peace and justice organizations, ongoing organizations in the country. Started in 1915, and I'm mentioning that particularly because we're moving into celebrating in 1915 a 100-year anniversary for the founding of WILF by Jane Addams and other feisty, terrific women. And in our local WILF, Women's International League, was started not too many years after that, in 1935, so we'll be moving into our 80th anniversary. So we're very, very proud to be part of this organization and very pleased and proud to be part of the WCOM family, which, like WILF, is volunteer-run, and we're always very pleased to be here. So this is our wake-up call. We come every Wednesday from 5 to 6, and we talk about the issues of the day, and we bring we have guests who have been involved in the issues of the day, or yesterday, as the case may be. And I'm very happy to introduce our guest today, Margaret Herring, who is a recent addition to Carrboro, moved here from Washington, I believe.
From Wilmington.
Wilmington. Mm-hmm. I knew it was with a W. So Margaret is, and she's a recent coming to our WILF meetings. And so, Margaret, welcome to our radio show.
Thank you.
We're so glad that you're able to come. I'll kind of do a setup thing that Margaret has a very part of important history of this country. She was in the civil rights movement starting in 1964 and had a pretty adventuresome and interesting and at times scary time. So Margaret, want to tell us about how you got started, maybe what led you to be involved in the civil rights movement?
Well, it happened over 50 years ago, so I'll try to remember how
way
it
back. Huh?
Yeah. I was living in Washington, D.C. with my first husband, and it was the time of the Berlin crisis, and everyone was worried about, because Washington was ground zero, which meant that they would be, Washington would be targeted by atomic weapons from the Soviet Union. So people were talking about things like, should we build a bomb shelter? Or should, you know, if we have a bomb shelter and the neighbor wants to come in, should we shoot that neighbor to preserve ourselves? And it was getting even more ridiculous. And on my job, I met some...
What kind of a job were you doing?
Well, at that time, I was working for Senator Steve Young of Ohio.
Okay.
He was a wild and crazy man. But anyway, and these lobbyists would come in, and two of them were from SANE, which was an organization for a sane nuclear policy. And they said the way to avoid a nuclear war was not to have a nuclear war. That made sense to me, so I got involved in the peace movement at that time, picketing the White House about the plans. Anyway.
I think some of us are old enough to also remember back yeah. how scary it was.
Yeah. It was, and also the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah.
Remember that?
And that's when the kids in school were told, if there's going to be an atomic attack, how to get under your desk.
Yeah, get under your desk.
Duck and cover, yes, indeed.
Duck and cover, yeah.
So that really happened.
It did.
I wanted to ask, you said you were working for a House Representatives member?
Senate.
Steve Young?
You know,
oh, Senate?
No.
Senator.
Uh-huh.
And you got involved in the peace movement.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well,
I mean,
because
you'd have been drummed out of the Corps if you'd done that any time in the last two decades at least. You'd have been fired on the spot.
Well, actually, he was a liberal senator, but he was... abusive to the staff. But anyway, so I quit, basically, and got a job with a newspaper man by the name of Drew Pearson.
Oh.
And so my job there was to open the mail and distribute the mail. And I also typed up his journal, which he would dictate every day about his meetings with all these interesting people. So I got to see a little bit behind the scenes of these power brokers in Washington.
Wow.
But I also started reading the mail that I opened, and especially what was happening in the South. This was 1964.
Mm-hmm.
So I was reading about the summer, Freedom Summer in 1964, where all of these volunteers went to Mississippi to try to register black people for voting. And they were not allowed to be registered. Mm-hmm. And actually, they got beaten up and put in jail, and their houses bombed, and they're kicked off of plantations, car insurance canceled. A lot of bad things happened to people who tried to register and vote. And I just admired these people that were going down to help with that process. And as the summer went on, I got more and more interested in it. And so I accompanied Mr. Pearson and Mrs. Pearson to the Democratic National Convention that year. And that was the year that Johnson wanted to decide who to have as a vice president. And he was leaning toward Hubert Humphrey as a vice president. So, you know, here we are. I decided that I would quit my job and go to Mississippi. While I was at the convention, I kept bugging Pearson to write something about what was happening in Mississippi, and he wouldn't listen. He got his information from Hubert Humphrey and other people, and Lyndon Johnson, actually. But one day he said, if you feel so strongly about this, then you go out and interview some of these people, and I'll put it in the column.
Wow.
So I said, okay. So that night I went out, and every evening there was a demonstration in front of the convention. What had happened in Mississippi is that because they had not allowed black people to vote, the SNCC and CORE and some NAACP chapters formed a third party.
These were civil rights organizations.
Yes.
For some people who are a little younger, SNCC, the Student Nonviolent
Coordinating Committee,
CORE, the
Congress of Racial Equality.
So these were all powerful or very involved civil rights organizations.
Yeah. They had divided the state into congressional districts and formed their own party and elected candidates who won and as nominees for the House of United States House of Representatives and for the United States Senate. So they came to the convention. Busloads of sharecroppers and poor people came to the convention to try to get seated. And Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer was a leader.
Ooh.
Annie Devine, Aaron Henry, you know, those were the candidates that were elected. And I was able to hear Mrs. Hamer's testimony before the Credentials Committee, where she told about what happened when they tried to register to vote and to attend Democratic Party precinct meetings. You can read about this in a lot of books, so I won't go
into it.
It
was on TV, at least.
Right.
So I'm not sure if it's the testimony you're referring to, because that was what was on TV. Heartrending.
Yes.
Emotional, right, hit you right in the gut, testifying what they were going through.
Yeah. You may not realize it, but when the time came for Mrs. Hamer's testimony, Lyndon Johnson called a press conference right at the moment of her testimony. And at this press conference, he said how important John Kennedy, we started talking about Kennedy or something irrelevant, to keep Mrs. Hamer's testimony from being live on the air. And the problem was that it got taped, so it was broadcast later, and people saw what happened. But that's the kind of manipulation he was trying to keep her testimony from getting out. But anyway, while I was there and all these things were happening, an older man came up to me and said, "Have you had enough to eat today?" Because I was hanging out with these people, and I said, yes, because I thought that was kind of odd. But then it dawned on me, he was asking because the other people may not have had enough to eat, the people from Mississippi. And he wanted to make sure that I was okay.
Wow.
It just really opened my eyes to the phoniness of the process with the Democratic Party at that time. So then I decided that I would quit my job and go to Mississippi, and where a place had been arranged for me to go. I didn't just bop down there. I was like going to assign to a project.
Did Drew Pearson keep his offer to you that some of the interviews you were doing, did he put them in his column?
I don't think so.
I wondered about that, yeah.
No, we kind of parted company
at that point, yeah.
And he had a radio show, did he?
Yes, he did. Yes. And he made predictions. Mm-hmm. He would always find out what was happening in these closed meetings because some of the senators would call him and tell him what would happen. So he was able to. But anyway, so that was.
Was the summer of 64. You decided to.
It was actually about September by the time I got ready to go.
So you went by yourself?
Or? Yeah, I drove down by myself.
What a brave thing to do. Well, did you have any contacts there?
Yes.
You had made friends at the convention.
And they had a place for me to do and work for me to do. So I did.
So were you doing that with like CORE or SNCC or?
Well, the CORE had two congressional districts and SNCC had the rest. I think three or four.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in a SNCC district, and mm-hmm. Stokely Carmichael was the district director for the projects in every county in Mississippi.
And this was voter registration project?
Voter registration, yes. Mm-hmm.
So this was after a lot of maybe the young people had gone home, the college students?
Some of them had gone home and some of them stayed.
Said stay. Mm-hmm. And so were there other... I know you were a lot younger then, but you were probably not a kid either of you, right?
No, I was older than
some of them.
Some of them, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So did they work out like a place to stay?
Yes.
Uh-huh. In people's homes?
Or? I stayed in someone's home,
mm-hmm.
and they wanted me to sleep behind the chimney because if a bomb came in, they wanted me to be safe.
Oh, for
and
goodness
so
sake.
It was like, oh, my goodness. They were so kind and glad to have us.
Yeah, a lot of people today, I mean, this history that you're talking about is so important because a lot of young people, you know, don't really realize. They may just read a few of the facts in a book, but to think of how scary it would be to go to Mississippi.
At that time.
The danger, yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people just think about the civil rights movement as being Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks. They have heard of that. But actually, it was a huge movement of regular, ordinary people, working people, poor people. It was a massive energy. And King was an eloquent spokesperson. But it took... just regular, ordinary, working-class people to bring about this huge change. And people don't realize the grassroots work that went into what we did.
Yeah, that's the other part of the story that gets faded away with time. And how many young people?
Yes, it was led by young people.
By young people.
And by local people, because... SNCC wanted to develop local leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Our philosophy did not include having a star come to town and make some speeches and lead a march and then flying off and leaving things the way they were. It meant to organize people into a powerful movement with local leadership. And so that was... part of the work that SNCC did.
that is such an important part of the story. How many women?
Yes, the women were a lot of women leaders. Yes,
that were such an important part of that. You know, we see some of these Martin Luther King and some of the other wonderful spokespeople.
Yes,
but a lot of the day by day. Work in danger was the ordinary people and a lot of women and a lot of young people putting. Yes.
The women provided a lot of leadership too, like Ella Baker and Fannie Lou Hamer, to name two. And Dorothy.
But I'm not sure how much the media,
Right.
Gave credence or their names out there the way some of the male leadership's names got out there more.
Yeah.
With whites and blacks. I mean, this was before the women's movement, let's face it.
Yes, it was before the women's
movement. But, it's always more so for any oppressed people. And for black women, it would be even less acknowledgement and confirmation than there'd be with white women. Yeah. So how long did you stay down there? Were you down there trying to register people to vote?
Well, what happened at the convention was that the delegation, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party delegation, was offered two seats on the floor of the convention. And they were urged by some leaders who you can read about to take this compromise. But Mrs. Hamer said, "We didn't come all this way for no two seats." So they rejected the compromise. So there was another challenge in January when Congress reconvened. There was a legal challenge to the seating of the regular Mississippi delegates like Senator Eastland, Representative Jamie Whitten, and others who were the old guard of the Democratic Party in Mississippi. So they again organized people in January when Congress opened to come to Washington. So Mrs. Hamer and Mrs. Devine, Aaron Henry, and others, Fannie Lou Hamer, were going to go to the Capitol building, the House of Representatives, and asked to be seated. But at the same time, a lawsuit was filed against the regular party. And the House of Representatives and the Senate have their own justice system, so that it was filed within that process. So once again, the buses full of poor Mississippi people came and lined the halls of Congress, lined the halls of the Senate office building and the tunnels from the office buildings to the Capitol. And all the representatives had to walk through these tunnels lined with black Mississippians.
Wow.
It was just so moving to have that happen. And so I worked on that second challenge by going around and collecting affidavits from all the counties in Mississippi so that they could be exhibits for the challenge.
Okay.
So then I was kind of pulled out of Batesville, where I had been sent, and moved around the state. And one of the reasons was that I was white and could talk Southern if the police stopped me. So...
Like
that. So anyway, that was very exciting work. And
were you brought up in the South?
Yes, I was raised in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Okay, so you had to talk Southern.
Yeah.
You had to probably exaggerate North Carolina a little bit to get Mississippi Southern.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's got a lot of molasses in it. So it was safer for you,
because
it was, all of this was dangerous work.
All was dangerous, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you drive by yourself?
Yes, I drove by myself.
Probably that was safer. Mm-hmm.
Only in the daylight, though.
And only the daylight. Yeah. Smart, yeah. Because Viola Liuzzo was white, and nighttime, she was not protected enough and was murdered. Yeah. So you did that, and so then how did that second challenge go?
Well, they lost again.
They lost again.
But that would have been January of 65. But later that year, the Voting Rights Act, Civil Rights Act, was passed by Congress. So it made it easier. The trouble was enforcing that law in Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia. How do you enforce the law?
So they passed the Voting Rights Act. Was part of that any mechanism for protection or enforcement of it? Or
yes, there was. And this is what was recently struck down by the Supreme
Court.
By
our
wonderful
court.
They took away all,
all that protection.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So then there you are. What happened next?
Well, after that, I went to work in the National SNCC office in Atlanta.
Okay.
And my job was, I worked for a wonderful woman named Betty Garman, and my job was to help raise money and also to get supplies to the projects, like clothes and gasoline money and cars and books for the Freedom Schools and school supplies. And so that's kind of what I worked on. And also I worked with the Medical Committee on Human Rights, and they provided medical care for all the workers. So if someone got sick, I got them a doctor.
So how many of you were in that central,
in the office?
The office, yeah.
Oh, I'd say about 35.
Oh, it was pretty big.
It was big, yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So they
it was a print shop. We printed our own leaflets and,
wow,
and booklets.
So they were funded by donations?
By donations, yes.
Yeah. Because at that point, I guess a lot of people were aware of the oppression and injustice and,
yeah,
and were sending,
yeah,
in money and trying to support the movement.
What happened in the North and the West Coast and Middle America was that the volunteers who came to Mississippi, the parents of the volunteers got involved. So they organized Friends of SNCC in the North, and they had fundraising parties and sent money. And I was a kind of liaison to those groups.
Okay.
And, you know, when someone was arrested and in jail, the calls went out immediately to the North, to the Friends of SNCC, about all the facts of what had happened. And those people would call the jail. They would call the press, and then they would call that jail in Mississippi and say, we understand that you have so-and-so in jail. We don't want to talk to him. Oh, you can't talk to him. Well, we know that he's there, and we're calling the Justice Department. We're calling the FBI, you know, to investigate. And if you lay a finger on him, you know, it will be hell to pay. So that was that kind of support that we had to get from people in the North.
So that was so important to keep those support systems going.
Very important.
Yeah. Brave ones who were kind of putting themselves right on the line.
Right.
Yeah. So how long did you work at that?
I worked until I worked through 65. And so what, think of all the things that happened in 1965, if you remember. Maybe you can help me remember some of them.
Mm.
But there was the Watts riot, and then James Meredith decided that he would walk from Memphis to Oxford, where the University of Mississippi was. And we thought that would be unsafe. But we had supported it because we had no choice. But it was during that
march. He was determined to do it.
And he went by himself. So we had people there to support him. And it was on that march that Willie Ricks and Stokely Carmichael first began to talk about black power and what that meant. And it was a very important meme to get out because it changed the movement. And by the way, I think also in, was April? March or April, there was a march from Selma to Montgomery.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the...
The Edmund Pettus Bridge?
Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. And John Lewis, Martin Luther King, was supposed to lead the march, but he said he just couldn't make it. And so John Lewis led the march, and he bore the brunt of the beatings from the state police. They beat those people terribly.
Mm.
He had concussions and other wounds about his head, and they just beat people with their batons, and it was just horrible. So that happened, and then later on, King led another march after he got leaders from the North to come and march with him. So it was a lot of people came the second march, and that was more successful. I mean, they didn't get hurt.
Because there was more national attention
national
and protection.
Leaders, national leaders.
So are we due for a...
I just wanted to comment that John Lewis was here.
Yes, I saw him,
This past Sunday.
You want to tell about that?
No, not in any great detail.
Okay.
I was there too, but I thought it's an interesting coincidence that, with your story.
Yeah.
And they've been celebrating at the Edmund Pettus Bridge for the last 22 years.
Yes, they have.
You went for one of the...
I went this past summer.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't summer. It was
spring
yeah. March.
Yeah.
It was in March.
Yeah.
And next year's the 50th.
Yeah, next year's the 50th anniversary.
Of that.
Yeah. And we also attended the Freedom School 50th anniversary this past year in Jackson, Mississippi.
Yeah.
At Tougaloo College.
Oh, Oh, were you there?
Yes.
Oh, wonderful. We should have told me.
Wow. So are we due for a station break right now?
Yeah, would be a good time for a station break.
Okay.
This is
And Margaret, this is, it's just bringing back so much, this history. But, time gets a little fuzzy and it's making it so vivid and the time frame of things. I'm so glad you're able to come. We're going to resume Margaret's story in the second part of the show.
Yes. This is the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom Hour, the wake-up call. And we're happy to be here today with our guest, Margaret Herring, who's been really wonderful, and we really appreciate it. My name is Dick Paddock, co-host of the show, and Lori Hoyt is our other co-host, and she'll be back in a moment. But in the meantime, we have some business, quote unquote, to take care of. We are brought to you and organized by the Triangle Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, which is as we said, approaching its 80th year, and we're so proud to be able to say that, and of course that we're members of the Women's International League and the National League, which are approaching their 100th anniversary. And we are brought to you, of course, on WCOM, LP, Chapel Hill, and Carrboro. And you can find WCOM's website at wcomfm.org. And you can either listen to us over the air, if you're close enough, on 103.5 FM, or you can stream us from the computer, from the website, the station's website, wcomfm.org. And our underwriter is Internationalist Bookstore, which is no longer at 405 West Franklin Street, but it's on Lloyd Street. I can see it right over there. If I stand up, I can
right around the corner from the radio station in downtown Carrboro.
Downtown Carrboro. And we're so happy for them that they have been able to upgrade their facilities and get out of that. It's the traditional location on Franklin Street and come into Lloyd Street in Carrboro.
And also that they have a parking, so it's much, I'm sure a lot of times people like myself went to go and you just couldn't get a parking place. It was very limited parking, and now they do have parking, so there's nothing to get in your way if you want to go over there and
right.
get some neat books
and
other things.
Yes. We should mention that the website is internationalistbooks.org.
Mm-hmm.
That's internationalistbooks.org. And the WILPF website is triangle WILPF.org. And I have another announcement that we'd like to make, and that is Hickory Tavern, which is right behind me here at the station, is going to host a fundraiser for WCOM.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, and so we want to tell you about that. The Hickory Tavern, located inside the Hampton Inn at 370 East Main Street in Carrboro.
Right next to the radio station.
Right next to the radio station.
Across the parking lot.
And the Art Center.
Where
we're located. We'll hold a fundraiser for the community radio station on Thursday night, November 6th, 2014.
It's coming up.
Yes. It's not all that far away.
No.
10% of food sales totals from receipts deposited will be donated to WCOM, a nonprofit all-volunteer community radio station serving Carrboro and Chapel Hill.
So please, all you listeners, if you care about community radio, please put this on your calendar. The radio station like WILPF, like the Internationalists, we're all nonprofit. We're all run by volunteers. We all don't have very much money, and it costs quite a bit of money to keep this radio station
right.
on the air, rent, and I'm sure we have a high electric bill.
Yes.
Yeah. So come, does it say it again, November 6th?
Yes, November 6th.
Is that all day?
2014. It doesn't say, but I am. There's a little handwritten note here that says 5 to 10 p.m., so I suspect that that's when it is.
Oh, 5 to 10 p.m.,
yeah.
Okay. So I'm putting it right in my little calendar right now. This is, and it's going to be fun.
Yes.
Okay, 5 to 10, and so, yeah, get yourself a beer, get yourself some good. Their food, I've heard, is absolutely delicious, so we've got to go check it out.
Yes.
So we can give a full report. I've had it once at a library program, and it was wonderful.
Good.
Okay.
Okay. That's all. It's time to go back to our interview.
Okay. So we ended the last segment on John Lewis being here, who's another
yes.
important name. And as Margaret said, he was one of the ones who was really severely beaten. He didn't have a lot of protection from as big a crowd or people from the north kind of providing a buffer. And those batons, I think some of them had iron pipes in them.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
The police didn't care.
They didn't care.
They were trying to kill us.
Yeah, they were.
Yeah.
So that was bringing us back. It's still in 1965, and James Meredith took his brave, courageous, lonely walk from Memphis to Oxford, Mississippi,
right.
and
yeah.
I don't think he made it, did he?
Not at that time, but he did. He was admitted later. I think, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Good for him. Yeah. So the struggle was on many fronts.
Yes, yes. Many fronts.
Yeah.
Anyway, the idea of black power, as Stokely Carmichael or Kwame Ture explained it, meant that the movement for black liberation would be run by black people. So what to do with us white people? And that plan was for us to go back to our homes, our people, and work in the white community with the same goals as SNCC had, which were to abolish racism, to stop the war in Vietnam, to have economic justice. So, but what that meant to us was that we had to go organize these people that had been shooting at us and explain to him their folly. But so it was quite a challenge that he gave us.
So, that is a big challenge,
A big challenge. So I left SNCC in December of 65, and I took a year off. I moved back to D.C. and got a job in an anti-poverty agency there in the planning department, and that's where I met my second husband, Al McShirley. So we...
In the planning department?
Well, he worked at a department that was organizing poor people in pockets of poverty around the Beltway of Washington. Uh-huh. So he had been a probation officer for Fairfax County, and he got involved with the youth. And so he was organizing these communities and doing some work on fair housing and things like that. So... we hooked up, and in 1967, we worked for an organization called SCEF, which was...
Called what?
SCEF.
S-K?
S-C-E-F.
S-C-E-F.
Mm-hmm. Southern Conference Educational Fund, which is an old civil rights organization started by Eleanor Roosevelt and Henry Wallace. People like that. Anyway, they had a project in the mountains of East Kentucky. So we joined that organization and worked in Pikeville.
So that's how
Kentucky.
You got to Kentucky.
You got to East Kentucky, which is a place where there's millions of dollars of coal taken out of the ground, but no taxes paid on the coal. So the miners, you know...
Oh.
Working in this dangerous industry and getting paid didn't get paid good wages.
So at all.
At all, yeah.
And the industry didn't pay any taxes?
I think they paid $200 a year for a license to mine coal.
Oh,
and
my
they took
gosh.
Millions and millions of dollars out of the area.
So they
and
were.
And didn't put anything back for schools or roads or health care. Or any social program.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine that? It's,
I mean, so how is it different now?
Well, I don't think that we changed very many things except ourselves.
Yeah.
But at the time that we got there, there was a fight against strip mining, which is now called mountaintop removal.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go to West Virginia and Kentucky, you'll see these beautiful mountains with the top taken off, and they're flat tops. And that means that all the stormwater runoff and the dirt and moves down into the creeks. The silt is there and fills up the creeks so that there's flooding where people live. And these coal operators were ruthless in that they would just push the dirt off the tops of the mountains down the hill, and sometimes they push graveyards over. It was just horrible. So local people had started protesting against that. And when Al and I got there, soon after we got there, we saw in the newspaper that the Chamber of Commerce had a meeting, and... the head of the Chamber of Commerce had said, we don't want these poverty workers organizing our poor. Our poor, right?
Well, at least they recognized who was causing it.
Yeah. So we thought that was interesting. And at the same time, we visited a local lawyer who had been helped some union people, some miners, who were charged with some conspiracy or something. So we made friends with him. And then in August the 7th, 1967, Our house was raided by about 17 men, including the district attorney, the sheriff, and a large posse of people. Came in our house about 6 or 7 o'clock, and I saw them coming from this field next door. I saw these men leaping over some tall grass, and I said, "Al, there's some guys with guns outside, and they look like they're chasing a criminal or something." And the next thing I knew, the back door opened, and they came in the kitchen, and there was a knock on the front door, and the sheriff was there, and Al opened the door, and the sheriff came in the room and said, "Where's Al Mac Shirley?" And he said, "I'm right here." And he was in the back of the crowd. It was hilarious, but scary at the same time.
Did you have children?
I was pregnant at the time.
You were pregnant at the time?
5 months pregnant, yeah. And they proceeded to go through all of our papers, and they took boxes off the shelf and took the bed apart and took the sofa apart. And looking at all of our dishes and looking for papers.
To incriminate you about something?
Al with sedition.
Sedition.
And then, as they were going through the papers, they found my stuff and that I had worked for SNCC, and so they arrested me too, which was a relief because I didn't want to be in the house by myself after they took him to jail. So we went to jail together. And so they had took all of
another form of togetherness, folks. Don't be left out.
The family that gets arrested together.
We want to do it together.
Anyway, so they took us off to jail, and on the way down, we were following a pickup truck with full of our papers. They had address lists. They had my diary and all of my love letters, which unfortunately I had saved. But they also had address lists of movement people. They had position papers, leaflets, newspaper clippings, everything. And so it was in the back of this pickup truck, and Al and I were laughing about, well, our papers are going to get distributed. You know, the wind is going to... not really. But I knew that Gandhi had been arrested for sedition. And so... But I wasn't exactly sure what it meant, and so he told me what it meant.
What does sedition mean? You're talking.
I'll get to that.
Okay.
So he went to the men's cell, and I went to the women's cell, and there were about 8 ladies in the cell. We all had beds, and so they said, "Well, what are you in for?" And I said, "I'm in for sedition." And they looked at each other. They weren't sure exactly what that meant. And I could tell they thought it was soliciting. And so I quickly said, "Well, sedition means that we teach people how to overthrow the government." And they smiled, and they said, "Well, that's what ought to be done." So anyway, that was... we were in jail for a week.
A week?
Mm-hmm. And as soon as... Well, during the search and seizure at our home, a friend called me just to check up and see how I was. And I answered the phone, and I said... "Well, would you please call Carl and Ann Braden of SCEF and tell them that our home is being raided and the sheriff and the Commonwealth's attorney are taking all of our papers?"
Oh, that they called while you were... That's well, right, you wouldn't have had a cell phone that would have been right...
That was a landline, of course.
Right, landline.
And so I said, "Tell them to call the lawyers, the movement lawyers, Bill Kunstler and Morty Stavis and Arthur Kanoy, and tell them to get themselves down here and tell them to call the press. So they did all of those things. They'd done it before. Because SCEF had helped start SNCC. It was a mother organization for other civil rights organizations. And I knew the lawyers from my work in Mississippi with the affidavits. So they did, and while we were in jail, the lawyers filed with the federal court to have the case removed from the state court to the federal court. Because you cannot overthrow one county in a state, overthrow the government in that county without overthrowing the whole United States. So it's a federal offense, should be a federal offense. And then we got out of jail and went to the hearing in Lexington where the federal judge took the law off the books. So the laws were taken off the books. There's a lot of other, I'm just the tip of the iceberg story. And but he gave the state time to appeal the ruling. So during that time, an investigator for the United States Senate Committee on Investigations, which was the old McCarthy Committee, chaired by Senator John McClellan, an investigator came and took 234 of our documents back to Senator McClellan, where they were perused and chuckled over, and see, they saw how dangerous we were. Anyway, so we got a subpoena for those papers while they still had those papers. And our lawyers went to the United States Supreme Court and had that subpoena quashed. It was like an emergency hearing.
Wow.
But and they held the papers for a whole year. We finally got them back in 1968 or 69. And a month after we got them back, our home was dynamited in an assassination attempt. They threw the dynamite at our bedroom window while, you know, an hour after we had gone to bed. And so they tried to kill us and kill the baby. By this time, the baby was about a year old. So that was pretty scary.
That's very... So this was back in Kentucky.
Back in Kentucky, yeah.
So that those local Kentucky people were still trying to get you.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, it didn't work out legally, so...
Yeah, they were going to kill us.
Oh, my God. So how did you escape? I mean, it just...
Well...
The dynamite hit
the screen of the window and bounced off. And it blew the side of the house, the siding and the windows and everything off, you know, destroyed the house. But we were okay.
Wow.
Had glass all over the place.
Oh, my God.
So it was
something. You were okay in that you weren't killed.
I wasn't killed. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're part of this explosion, but it just...
Yeah, yeah.
You survived it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
So then did they give up, or...?
Well, no. The Senate issued another subpoena, and there was a hearing before the Senate committee, which included Sam Ervin from North Carolina, that they closed. They wouldn't let the public in. There were about 300 people outside wanting to come to the hearing, and they wouldn't let them in. And we refused to hand over the documents. But on the way to the hearing, we stopped at the federal court and filed a lawsuit against the Senate committee for violating our Fourth Amendment rights. The Fourth Amendment covers the right to privacy. So that was certainly violated.
Yeah.
So we filed this suit, and at the hearing, we said we're not going to give you any papers, but we will give you the brief of a suit against you that we just filed in federal court. The reason for filing it in federal court before the, 30 minutes before the hearing was so that the suit could not be thrown out before the hearing happened, because it could have been. So we didn't want to take any chances.
Boy, oh boy.
So we had the hearing, and then later they found us in contempt of Congress. And so there was a criminal case against us for that. So we lost that, but won on appeal. And then we had our civil case against them, many years later, because we had volunteer attorneys, we had fundraisers to pay for depositions. So anyway, we finally won that case.
You finally won. It took 20 years, I think?
It took about 18 years.
About 18 years.
And meanwhile, our marriage was destroyed.
So, with all that stress, you have a marriage.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
And
we're good friends. I'm friends with Al.
But you're good friends. Well, good for you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, people don't realize that these things...
take a personal toll.
It takes such a personal toll. I mean, oh, good Lord. Well, thank goodness that you got a little bit of justice at the end,
yes,
but it took its toll.
Yeah,
there's a lot of wounds that don't show up on the outside but are there.
Mm-hmm.
We're almost running out of it. Margaret, this has just been, I just heard the highlights from Lucy, and I'm just so glad to hear from you. And we're only up to 1969, except 20 years later that it won. Maybe at some point you can come back and fill us in about your exciting life. It's been so. I just have to ask you: did you stay doing movement work?
Yes,
I'm not surprised. Yeah.
And I've been very thrilled by the Moral Monday movement, and of course Al is one of the leaders in that.
Yeah.
And I'm very proud of the work that he's done.
Yeah.
It's really given me hope for North Carolina.
Yeah.
Reverend Barber, what he's done, and having all of those demonstrations, it's just so exciting, and I sure hope people get out and vote in November.
I hope people do, because everybody complains. I hope that they put their bodies where their mouth is.
Yes.
And get out there and get, if everyone brings 10 people, encourages
to the polls,
10
yeah.
people to get out and vote.
Yeah.
We've had Margaret Herring on, who's a new WILF member and a new friend, who was a pioneer with the civil rights movement starting in 64 up to the present. And we are the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. This is the WILF Show, our wake-up call, and we always keep trying to connect the dots, how all of this is connected, all this work for justice takes many forms. And and Dick, how are we doing?
Oh, we've got a little bit of time left, not a whole lot, but I wanted to mention that following us immediately after our show is the NC... why am I blanking? Policy Watch, NC Policy Watch show.
Chris Fitzsimon.
Yes, News and Views. Chris Fitzsimon will be on, as usual. Excuse me, straight up 6 o'clock. And I also want to remind you the Hickory Tavern fundraiser.
Yes.
That's going to be
fundraiser for this wonderful radio station.
And it's on November 6th. That's... 4 weeks away, roughly.
Coming along.
10% of food sales from the receipts will be donated to WCOM. And so
when you go, make sure you hold on to your receipt.
Right. And and eat a lot, so that it's a big, big receipt.
Yes. Don't eat lunch. Go hungry, go thirsty, and and help out this wonderful radio station.
Yep. And so we thank you very much.
And see you next week, every Wednesday from 5 to 6.
5 to 6.
We're here.
Yep.
So I'm Lori Hoyt. That's Dick Paddock.
Dick Paddock.
And we just had Margaret Herring on as a guest.
This is W.